two versions of the same story, one as the printed page, the other as shadow images across a television screen. When I first came out to the coast in 1962, many of my friends mourned, "That's the last we see of him in print." They had swallowed the cliché myths, hook, line, and stinker. But as anyone can tell from the 120,000 words I've written in just short stories alone in the past 5 years, it is not the town, nor its opulence, nor living well, nor working in a different medium that ruins a writer. It is his own inability to get a handle on life. It killed Fitzgerald and Horace McCoy out here, but the town had very little to do with it. In fact, Hollywood offers some very special and invaluable assistance for a writer who works in the marketplace. It provides sufficient funds so he can live not merely well, but very well. I don't think there is anything particularly noble, uplifting, or artistically enriching about being dirt poor past a certain point. At first, it helps because it brings a writer into close contact with his subject matter, with the world, and with the exigencies of reality. But by the time you hit 30, you'd better damned well be living like a mensch, or you cannot, in all good conscience, call yourself a bohemian. You're merely a seedy bum. As a corollary, it goes hand in hand. The better a writer gets at his craft, the more he sells. The more he sells, the better known his name becomes. The better known he becomes, the more money they give you, and the better you live. It isn't always a yardstick for quality, but it helps. Hollywood also brings recognition. I co-scripted a dreadful motion picture whose name I will not mention here, and if you saw it and were as nauseated as I was, then I extend my sincerest apologies for having contributed to something as dishonest and cheapjack as the epic in question. But even when the work is bad, the great unwashed learns about it, and a writer may find himself confronted, as I was, by the singular spectacle of his name 10 feet high in Times Square. It is a heady wine. But the most important benefit Hollywood offers is an association with the visual medium, as exciting and demanding an arena as any open to a writer in our times. Many of my stories in magazines have been translated into scripts. Some of them work very nicely. The one that follows is an example. It was a statement of anti-war sentiments on my part, and when Hans Stefan Santesson originally bought it for Fantastic Universe in 1957, he gave me $91 for it. That was a pile of money for me at the time. In 1964, when I rewrote and adapted the story for television, I received $5,000. Times change, media change, but my beliefs about the senseless stupidity of war remain unchanged. Though I served my 2 years in the Army, were I to be called up now, I would refuse to serve. I'm afraid I would have to go to jail like Tommy Rodd, a boy I've never met but for whom I feel great brotherhood. He literally follows the philosophy of Thoreau that, quote, "he serves the state best who opposes it the most," unquote. Were I in his position, I would try to be as heroic, as brave, but as I am not, the best I can do is sit on my fat ass, write my stories, take their $5,000, and hope that out there in Knob Twiddlesville, the great unwashed who would shriek in horror if two lovely people fornicated with pleasure on their TV screen, but who purr with patriotic delight when their sons are decorated in Vietnam for miscalculating and dropping a little defoliation on U.S. troops or amber-skinned babies in schoolyards, will one day soon come to their senses, rise up in their wrath, and send all the face-saving politicians scuttling to their holes, rather than allow them to continue senseless warfare in remote corners of a globe that has come to think of us in terms of atrocities and aggression. Some of this I tried to say in the story and teleplay that follow. But for those who need ready categorizations to ignore the unsettling remarks of others, I am not now, nor have I ever been, anything Robert Welch and his birchies would consider subversive. I'm just a guy, like many out there, who has come to maturity realizing God ain't necessarily on our side. In point of fact, I don't think he can ever be on the side of the soldier. Quarlo hunkered down farther into the firm hole, gathering his cloak about him. Even the triple lining of the cape could not prevent the seeping cold of the battlefield from reaching him, and even through one of those linings, lead impregnated, he could feel the faint tickle of dropout all around him, eating at his tissues. He began to shiver again. The push was going on to the south, and he had to wait, had to listen for the telepathic command of his superior officer. He fingered an edge of the firm hole, noting he had not steadied it up too well with the firmer. He drew the small molecule hardening instrument from his pouch and examined it. The calibrator had slipped a notch, which explained why the dirt of the firm hole had not become as hard as he had desired. Off to the left, the hiss of an 80-thread beam split the night air, and he shoved the firmer back quickly. The spiderweb tracery of the beam lanced across the sky, poked tentatively at an armor center, throwing blood-red shadows across Quarlo's crag-like features. The armor center backtracked the thread beam, retaliated with a blinding flash of its own batteries. One burst, two, three. The 80-thread reared once more, feebly, then subsided. A moment later, the concussion of its power chambers exploding shook the earth around Quarlo, causing bits of unfirmed dirt and small pebbles to tumble in on him. Another moment, and the shrapnel came through. Quarlo lay flat to the ground, soundlessly hoping for a bit more life amidst all this death. He knew his chances of coming back were infinitesimal. What was it? 3 out of every 1,000 came back? He had no illusions. He was a common footman, and he knew he would die out here, in the midst of the Great War 7. As though the detonation of the 80 thread had been a signal, the weapons of Quarlo's company opened up full on. The webbings crisscrossed the blackness overhead with delicate patterns, appearing, disappearing, changing with every second, ranging through the spectrum, washing the bands of colors outside the spectrum Quarlo could catalog. Quarlo slid into a tiny ball in the slush-filled bottom of the firm hole, waiting. He was a good soldier. He knew his place. When those metal and energy beasts out there were snarling at each other, there was nothing a lone foot soldier could do but die. He waited, knowing his time would come much too soon. No matter how violent, how involved, how push-button-ridden wars became, it always simmered down to the man on foot. It had to, for men fought men still. His mind dwelled limply in a state between reflection and alertness, a state all men of war came to know when there was nothing but the thunder of the big guns abroad in the night. The stars had gone into hiding. Abruptly, the thread beams cut out, the traceries winked off. Silence once again descended. Quarlo snapped to instant attentiveness. This was the moment. His mind was now keyed to one sound, one only. Inside his head, the command would form and he would act, not entirely of his own volition. The strategists and psych men had worked together on this thing. The tone of command was keyed into each soldier's brain, printed in, probed in, sunken in. It was there, and when the regimenter sent his telepathic orders, Quarlo would leap like a puppet and advance on direction. Thus, when it came, it was as though he had anticipated it, as though he knew a second before the mental rasping and the advance erupted within his skull that the moment had arrived. A second sooner than he should have been, he was up, out of the firm hole, hugging his Brandelmeier to his chest, the weight of the plastic bandoliers and his pouch reassuring across his stomach, back, and hips, even before the mental word actually came. Because of this extra moment's jump on the command, it happened. And it happened just that way. No other chance coincidences could have done it, but those, just that way, done just that way. When the first blasts of the enemy's zeroed-in batteries met the combined rays of Quarlo's own guns, also pinpointed, they met at a point that should, by all rights, have been empty. But Quarlo had jumped too soon, and when they met, the soldier was at the focal point. 300 distinct beams latticed down, joined in a coruscating rainbow, threw negatively charged particles 500 feet in the air, shorted out, and warped the soldier off the battlefield. Nathan Schwachter had his heart attack right there on the subway platform. The soldier materialized in front of him, from nowhere, filthy and ferocious looking, a strange weapon cradled to his body, just as the old man was about to put a penny in the candy machine. Quarlo's long cape was still, the dematerialization and subsequent reappearance having left him untouched. He stared in confusion at the sallow face before him and started violently at the face's piercing shriek. Quarlo watched with growing bewilderment and terror as the sallow face contorted and sank to the littered floor of the platform. The old man clutched his chest, twitched, and gasped several times. His legs jerked spasmodically and his mouth opened wildly again and again. He died with mouth open, eyes staring at the ceiling. Quarlo looked at the body disinterestedly for a moment. Death? What did one death matter? Every day during the war, 10,000 died. More horribly than this, this was nothing to him. The sudden, universe-filling scream of an incoming express train broke his attention. The black tunnel that his war-filled world had become was filled with the rusty wail of an unseen monster bearing down on him out of the darkness. The fighting man in him made his body arch, sent it into a crouch. He poised on the balls of his feet, his rifle levering horizontal instantly, pointed at the sound. From the crowds packed on the platform, a voice rose over the thunder of the incoming train.
Him! It was him! He shot that old man! He's crazy!
Heads turned, eyes stared. A little man with a dirty vest, his bald head reflecting the glow of the overhead lights, was pointing a shaking finger at Quarlo. It was as if two currents had been set up simultaneously. The crowd both drew away and advanced on him. Then the train barreled around the curve, drove past, blasting sound into the very fibers of the soldier's body. Quarlo's mouth opened wide in a soundless scream, and more from reflex than intent, the Brandlmeyer erupted in his hands. A triple thread of cold blue beams sizzled from the small bell mouth of the weapon, streaked across the tunnel, and blasted full into the front of the train. The front of the train melted down quickly, and the vehicle ground to a stop. The metal had been melted like a coarse grade of plastic on a burner. Where it had fused into a soggy lump, the metal was bright and smeary, more like the gleam of oxidized silver than anything else. Quarlo regretted having fired the moment he felt the Brandlmeyer buck. He was not where he should be. Where he was, that was still another more pressing problem, and he knew he was in danger. Every movement had to be watched as carefully as possible, and perhaps he had gotten off to a bad start already, but that noise! He had suffered the screams of the battlefield, but the reverberations of the train, thundering back and forth in that enclosed space, were a nightmare of indescribable horror. As he stared dumbly at his handiwork, from behind him, the crowd made a concerted rush. Three burly, charcoal-suited executives, each carrying an attaché case which he dropped as he made the lunge, looking like unhealthy carbon copies of each other, grabbed Quarlo above the elbows, around the waist, about the neck. The soldier roared something unintelligible and flung them from him. One slid across the platform on the seat of his pants, bringing up short, his stomach and face smashing into a tiled wall. The second spun away, arms flailing into the crowd. The third tried to hang on to Quarlo's neck. The soldier lifted him bodily, arched him over his head, breaking the man's insecure grip, and pitched him against a stanchion. The executive hit the girder, slid down, and lay quite still, his back oddly twisted. The crowd emitted scream after scream, drew away once more. Terror rippled back through its ranks. Several women near the front suddenly became aware of the blood pouring from the face of one of the executives and keeled onto the dirty platform, unnoticed. The screams continued, seeming echoes of the now-dead express trains squealing. But as an entity, the crowd backed the soldier down the platform. For a moment, Quarlo forgot he still held the Brandlemeyer. He lifted the gun to a threatening position, and the entity that was the crowd pulsed back. Nightmare. It was all some sort of vague, formless nightmare to Quarlo. This was not the war where anyone he saw he blasted. This was something else. Some other situation in which he was lost, disoriented. What was happening? Quarlo moved toward the wall, his back prickly with fear sweat. He had expected to die in the war, but something as simple and direct and expected as that had not happened. He was here. Not there. Wherever here was, and wherever there had gone. And these people were unarmed, obviously civilians. Which would not have kept him from murdering them. But what was happening? Where was the battlefield? His progress toward the wall was halted momentarily as he backed cautiously around a stanchion. He knew there were people behind him as well as the white-faced knots before him, and he was beginning to suspect there was no way out. Such confusion boiled up in his thoughts, so close to hysteria was he, plain soldier of the fields, that his mind forcibly rejected the impossibility of being somehow transported from the war into this new, and in many ways more terrifying, situation. He concentrated on one thing only, as a good soldier should. Out. He slid along the wall, the crowd flowing before him, opening at his approach, closing in behind. He whirled once, driving them back farther with the black hole of the Brandlemeyer's bellmouth. Again, he hesitated, not knowing why, to fire upon them. He sensed they were enemies, but still they were unarmed, and yet that had never stopped him before. The village in Tetromsk territory, beyond the Volga somewhere. They had been unarmed there, too, but the square had been filled with civilians he had not hesitated to burn. Why was he hesitating now? The Brandlemeyer continued in its silence. Quarlo detected a commotion behind the crowd, above the crowd's inherent commotion, and a movement. Something was happening there. He backed tightly against the wall as a blue-suited, brass-buttoned man broke through the crowd. The man took one look, caught the unwinking black eye of the Brandlemeyer, and threw his arms back, indicating to the crowd to clear away. He began screaming at the top of his lungs, veins standing out in his temples.
"Get out of here! The guy's a cuckaboo! Somebody will get killed! Beat it! Run!"
The crowd needed no further impetus. It broke in the center and streamed toward the stairs. Quarlo swung around, looking for another way out, but both accessible stairways were dogged by fighting commuters, shoving each other mercilessly to get out. He was effectively trapped. The cop fumbled at his holster. Quarlo caught a glimpse of the movement from the corner of his eye. Instinctively, he knew the movement for what it was. A weapon was about to be brought into use. He swung about, leveling the Brandlemeyer. The cop jumped behind a stanchion just as the soldier pressed the firing stud. A triple thread of bright blue energy leaped from the weapon's bell mouth. The beam went over the heads of the crowd, neatly melting away a 5-foot segment of wall supporting one of the stairways. The stairs creaked, and the sound of tortured metal adjusting to poor support and an overcrowding of people rang through the tunnel. The cop looked fearfully above himself, saw the beams curve, then settle under the weight, and turned a wide-eyed stare back at the soldier. The cop fired twice from behind the stanchion. The booming of the explosions catapulting back and forth in the enclosed space. The second bullet took the soldier above the wrist in his left arm. The Brandlemeyer slipped uselessly from his good hand as blood stained the garment he wore. He stared at his shattered lower arm in amazement. Doubled amazement. What manner of weapon was this the blue-coated man had used? No beam that. Nothing like anything he had ever seen before. No beam to fry him in his tracks. It was some sort of power that hurled a projectile that had ripped his body. He stared stupidly as blood continued to flow out of his arm. The cop, less anxious now to attack this man with the weird costume and unbelievable rifle, edged cautiously from behind his cover, skirting the edge of the platform, trying to get near enough to Quarlo to put another bullet into him, should he offer further resistance. But the soldier continued to stand, spraddle-legged, staring at his wound, confused at where he was, what had happened to him, the screams of the trains as they bulleted past, and the barbarian tactics of his blue-coated adversary. The cop moved slowly, steadily, expecting the soldier to break and run at any moment. The wounded man stood rooted, however. The cop bunched his muscles and leaped the few feet intervening. Savagely, he brought the barrel of his pistol down on the side of Quarlo's neck near the ear. The soldier turned slowly, anchored in his tracks, and stared unbelievingly at the policeman for an instant. Then his eyes glazed, and he collapsed to the platform. As a gray, swelling mist bobbed up around his mind, one final thought impinged incongruously. He struck me. Physical contact? I don't believe it. What have I gotten into? Light filtered through vaguely. Shadows slithered and wavered, sullenly formed into solids. Hey, Mac, got a light? Shadows blocked Quarlo's vision, but he knew he was lying on his back, staring up. He turned his head, and a wall oozed into focus, almost at his nose tip. He turned his head the other way. Another wall, about 3 feet away, blending in his sight into a shapeless gray blotch. He abruptly realized the back of his head hurt. He moved slowly, swiveling his head, but the soreness remained. Then he realized he was lying on some hard metal surface, and he tried to sit up. The pains throbbed higher, making him feel nauseated, and for an instant, his vision receded again. Then it steadied, and he sat up slowly. He swung his legs over the sharp edge of what appeared to be a shallow, sloping metal trough. It was a mattressless bunk, curved in its bottom from hundreds of men who had lain there before him. He was in a cell. Hey, I said you got a match there. Quarlo turned from the empty rear wall of the cell and looked through the bars. A bulb-nosed face was thrust up close to the metal barrier. The man was short, in filthy rags, whose odor reached Quarlo with tremendous offensiveness. The man's eyes were bloodshot, and his nose was crisscrossed with blue and red veins. Acute alcoholism, reeking from every pore. Acne rosacea, that had turned his nose into a hideous, cracked and pocked blob. Quarlo knew he was in detention, and from the very look, the very smell of this other, he knew he was not in a military prison. The man was staring in at him, oddly. Match, Charlie? You got a match? He puffed his fat, wet lips at Quarlo, forcing the bit of cigarette stub forward with his mouth. Quarlo stared back. He could not understand the man's words. They were so slowly spoken, so sharp and yet unintelligible, but he knew what to answer.
My name's Quarlo Krablerny, Cis File 10229.
The soldier muttered by rote, surly tones running together.
What are you mad at me for, buddy? I didn't punch you in here, argued the match seeker. All I wanted was a light for this here butt.
He held up 2 inches of smoked stub.
How come they got you in a cell and not running around loose in a bullpen like us?
He cocked a thumb over his shoulder, and for the first time, Quarlo realized others were in this jail.
Ah, the hell with you,
the drunk muttered. He cursed again, softly under his breath, turning away. He walked across the bullpen and sat down with the 4 other men, all vaguely similar in facial content, who lounged around a rough-hewn table-bench combination. The table and benches, all one piece like a picnic table, were bolted to the floor.
Screw loose, the drunk said to the others,
nodding his balding head at the soldier in his long cape and metallic skin-tight suit. He picked up the crumpled remnants of an ancient magazine and leafed through it as though he knew every line of type, every girly illustration by heart. Quarlo looked over the cell. It was about 10 feet high by 8 across, a sink with one thumb-push spigot running cold water, a commode without seat or paper, and metal trough, roughly the dimensions of an average-sized man fastened to one wall. One enclosed bulb burned feebly in the ceiling. 3 walls of solid steel. Ceiling and floor of the same, riveted together at the seams. The 4th wall was the barred door. The firmer might be able to wilt that steel, he realized, and instinctively reached for his pouch. It was the first moment he had had a chance to think of it, and even as he reached, he knew the satisfying weight of it was gone. His bandoliers also. His Brandelmeier, of course. His boots, too, and there seemed to have been some attempt to get his cape off, but it was all part of the skin-tight suit of metallic mesh cloth. The loss of the pouch was too much. Everything that had happened so quickly, so blurry, meshed, and the soldier was abruptly overcome by confusion and a deep feeling of hopelessness. He sat down on the bunk, the ledge of metal biting into his thighs. His head still ached from a combination of the blow dealt him by the cop and the metal bunk where he had lain. He ran a shaking hand over his head, feeling the fractional inch of his brown hair cut battle style. Then he noticed that his left hand had been bandaged quite expertly. There was hardly any throbbing from his wound. That brought back to sharp awareness all that had transpired, and the war leaped into his thoughts. The telepathic command, the rising from the firm hole, the rifle at the ready, then a sizzling shush, and the universe had exploded around him in a billion tiny flickering novas of color and color. Then suddenly, just as suddenly as he had been standing on the battlefield of Great War VII, advancing on the enemy forces of Rusky Chink, he was not there. He was here. He was in some dark, hard tunnel, with a great beast roaring out of the blackness onto him, and a man in a blue coat had shot him and clubbed him, actually touched him, without radiation gloves. How had the man known Quarlo was not booby-trapped with radiates? He could have died in an instant. Where was he? What war was this he was engaged in? Were these Rusky Chink or his own Tricontinenters? He didn't know. And there was no sign of an explanation. Then he thought of something more important. If he had been captured, then they must want to question him. There was a way to combat that, too. He felt around in the hollow tooth toward the back of his mouth. His tongue touched each tooth till it hit the right lower bicuspid. It was empty. The poison glob was gone, he realized in dismay. It must have dropped out when the blue coat clubbed me, he thought. He realized he was at their mercy. Who they might be was another thing to worry about, and with the glob gone, he had no way to stop their extracting information. It was bad, very bad, according to the warning conditioning he had received. They could use probers, or dioxyl scopolite, or hypnoscourge, or any one of 100 different methods, any one of which would reveal to them the strength of numbers in his company, the battery placements, the gun ranges, the identity and thought wave band of every officer. In fact, a good deal, more than he had thought he knew. He had become a very important prisoner of war. He had to hold out, he realized. Why? The thought popped up and was gone. All it left in its wake was the intense feeling, I despise war, all war and the war. Then even that was gone, and he was alone with the situation once more to try and decide what had happened to him, what secret weapon had been used to capture him, and if these unintelligible barbarians with the projectile weapons could indeed extract his knowledge from him. I swear they won't get anything out of me but my name, rank, and serial number, he thought desperately. He mumbled those particulars aloud as reassurance.
My name's Carlo Clebregni, Pride, 6510229.
The drunks looked up from their table and their shakes at the sound of his voice. The man with the rose-drop nose rubbed a dirty hand across fleshy chin folds, repeated his philosophy of the strange man in the locked cell.
Screw loose.
He might have remained in jail indefinitely, considered a madman or a mad rifleman. But the desk sergeant who had booked him after the soldier had received medical attention grew curious about the strangely shaped weapon. As he put the things into security, he tested the Brandlmeyer, hardly realizing what knob or stud controlled its power, never realizing what it could do, and melted away one wall of the safe room. 3-inch plate steel, and it melted bluely, fused solidly. He called the captain, and the captain called the FBI, and the FBI called internal security, and internal security said, "Preposterous," and checked back. When the Brandlmeyer had been thoroughly tested, as much as could be tested, since the rifle had no seams, no apparent power source, and fantastic range, they were willing to believe. They had the soldier removed from his cell, transported along with the pouch, and a philologist named Soames to the IS General Headquarters in Washington, D.C. The Brandlmeyer came by jet courier, and the soldier was flown in by helicopter under sedation. The philologist named Soames, whose hair was long and rusty, whose face was that of a starving artist, whose temperament was that of a saint, came in by specially chartered plane from Columbia University. The pouch was sent by sealed Brinks truck to the airport, where it was delivered under heaviest guard to a mail plane. They all arrived in Washington within 10 minutes of one another, and without seeing anything of the surrounding countryside, were whisked away to the subsurface levels of the IS buildings. When Quarlo came back to consciousness, he found himself again in a cell, this time quite unlike the first. No bars, but just as solid to hold him in, with padded walls. Quarlo paced around the cell a few times, seeking breaks in the walls, and found what was obviously a door in one corner, but he could not work his fingers between the pads to try and open it. He sat down on the padded floor and rubbed the bristled top of his head in wonder. Was he never to find out what had happened to him? And when was he going to shake the strange feeling that he was being watched? Overhead, through a pane of one-way glass that looked like a ventilator grill, the soldier was being watched. Lyle Sims and his secretary knelt before the window in the floor, along with the philologist named Soames. Where Soames was shaggy, ill-kept, hungry-looking, and placid, Lyle Sims was lean, collegiate-seeming, brusque, and brisk. He had been special advisor to an unnamed branch office of internal security for 5 years, dealing with every strange or offbeat problem too outré for regulation inquiry. Those years had hardened him in an odd way. He was quick to recognize authenticity, even quicker to recognize fakery. As he watched, his trained instincts took over completely, and he knew in a moment of spying that the man in the cell below was out of the ordinary. Not so in any fashion that could be labeled drunkard, foreigner, psychotic, but so markedly different, so other, he was taken aback. 6'3", he recited to the girl kneeling beside him. She made the notation on her pad, and he went on calling out characteristics of the soldier below. Brown hair, clipped so short you can see the scalp. Black eyes. Scars above the left eye running down to center of left cheek, bridge of nose. 3 parallel scars on the right side of chin. Tiny one over right eyebrow. Last one I can see runs from back of left ear into hairline. Seems to be wearing an all-over skin-tight suit, something like, I suppose it's like a pair of, what do you call those pajamas kids wear, the kind with the back door, the kind that enclose the feet? The girl inserted softly, "You mean snuggies?" The man nodded, slightly embarrassed for no good reason, continued, "Yes, that's right, like those." The suit encloses his feet, seems to be joined to the cape, and comes up to his neck. Seems to be some sort of metallic cloth. Something else may mean nothing at all, or, on the other hand, he pursed his lips for a moment, then described his observation carefully. His head seems to be oddly shaped. The forehead is larger than most, seems to be pressing forward in front as though he had been smacked hard and it was swelling. That seems to be everything. Sims settled back on his haunches, fished in his side pocket, and came up with a small pipe, which he cold-puffed in thought for a second. He rose slowly, still staring down through the floor window. He murmured something to himself, and when Soames asked what he had said, the special advisor repeated, "I think we've got something almost too hot to handle." Soames clucked knowingly and gestured toward the window. "Have you been able to make out anything he's said yet?" Sims shook his head. "No. That's why you're here. It seems he's saying the same thing over and over, but it's completely unintelligible. Doesn't seem to be any recognizable language or any dialect we've been able to pin down."
"I'd like to take a try at him," Soames said, smiling gently. It was the man's nature that challenge brought satisfaction. Solution brought unrest, eagerness for a new, more rugged problem.
Sims nodded agreement, but there was a tense, strained film over his eyes in the set of his mouth. "Take it easy with him, Soames. I have a strong hunch this is something completely new, something we haven't even begun to understand." Soames smiled again, this time indulgently.
"Come, come, Mr. Sims. After all, he is only an alien of some sort. All we have to do is find out what country he's from."
"Have you heard him talk yet?" Soames shook his head. "Then don't be too quick to think he's just a foreigner. The word alien may be more correct than you think, only not in the way you think." A confused look spread across Soames' face. He gave a slight shrug, as though he could not fathom what Lyle Sims meant, and was not particularly interested. He patted Sims reassuringly, which brought an expression of annoyance to the advisor's face, and he clamped down on the pipe stem harder. They walked downstairs together. The secretary left them to type her notes, and Sims let the philologist into the padded room, cautioning him to deal gently with the man. "Don't forget," Sims warned. "We're not sure where he comes from, and sudden movements may make him jumpy. There's a guard overhead, and there'll be a man with me behind this door, but you never know."
Soames looked startled. "You sound as though he's an aborigine or something. With a suit like that, he must be very intelligent. You suspect something, don't you?"
Sims made a neutral motion with his hands. "What I suspect is too nebulous to worry about now. Just take it easy, and above all, figure out what he's saying, where he's from." Sims had decided long before that it would be wisest to keep the power of the Brandelmeier to himself. But he was fairly certain it was not the work of a foreign power. The trial run on the test range had left him gasping, confused. He opened the door, and Soames passed through uneasily. Sims caught a glimpse of the expression on the stranger's face as the philologist entered. It was even more uneasy than Soames's had been. It looked to be a long wait. Soames was white as paste. His face was drawn, and the complacent attitude he had shown since his arrival in Washington was shattered. He sat across from Sims and asked him, in a quavering voice, for a cigarette. Sims fished around in his desk, came up with a crumpled pack, and idly slid them across to Soames. The philologist took one, put it in his mouth, then, as though it had been totally forgotten in the space of a second, he removed it, held it while he spoke. His tones were amazed.
"Do you know what you've got up there in that cell?"
Sims said nothing. Knowing what was to come would not startle him too much. He had expected something fantastic.
"That man, do you know where he, that soldier, and by God, Sims, that's what he is, comes from, now you're going to think I'm insane to believe it, but somehow I'm convinced
He comes from the future.
Sims tightened his lips. Despite himself, he was shocked. He knew it was true. It had to be true. It was the only explanation that fit all the facts. What can you tell me? He asked the philologist.
Well, at first, I tried solving the communications problem by asking him simple questions, pointing to myself and saying Soames, pointing to him and looking quizzical, but all he'd keep saying was a string of gibberish. I tried for hours to equate his tones and phrases with all the dialects and subdialects of every language I'd ever known, but it was no use. He slurred too much. And then I finally figured it out. He had to write it out, which I couldn't understand, of course, but it gave me a clue, and then I kept having him repeat it. Do you know what he's speaking?
Sims shook his head. The linguist spoke softly.
He's speaking English. It's that simple. Just English. But an English that has been corrupted and run together and so slurred it's incomprehensible. It must be the future trend of the language, sort of an extrapolation of gutter English just contracted to a fantastic extreme. At any rate, I got it out of him.
Sims leaned forward, held his dead pipe tightly.
What?
Soames read it off a sheet of paper.
My name is Quarlo Clobregni, Private 6510229.
Sims murmured in astonishment.
My God, name, rank, and...
Soames finished for him.
And serial number, yes. That's all he'd give me for over 3 hours. Then I asked him a few innocuous questions, like where did he come from, and what was his impression of where he was now?
The philologist waved a hand vaguely.
By that time, I had an idea what I was dealing with, though not where he had come from. But when he began telling me about the war he was fighting when he showed up here, I knew immediately he was either from some other world, which is fantastic, or, I just don't know.
Sims nodded his head in understanding.
From when do you think he comes?
Soames shrugged.
Can't tell. He says the year he is in, doesn't seem to realize he's in the past, is K79. He doesn't know when the other style of dating went out. As far as he knows, it's been K for a long time, though he's heard stories about things that happened during a time they dated GV. Meaningless, but I'd wager it's more thousands of years than we can imagine.
Sims ran a hand nervously through his hair. This problem was indeed larger than he'd thought. Look, Professor Soames, I want you to stay with him and teach him current English. See if you can work some more information out of him and let him know we mean him no hard times. Though Lord knows, the special advisor added with a tremor, he can give us a harder time than we can give him. What knowledge he must have. Soames nodded in agreement.
Is it all right if I catch a few hours' sleep? I was with him almost 10 hours straight, and I'm sure he needs it as badly as I do.
Sims nodded also in agreement, and the philologist went off to a sleeping room. But when Sims looked down through the window 20 minutes later, the soldier was still awake, still looking about nervously. It seemed he did not need sleep. Sims was terribly worried, and the coded telegram he had received from the president in answer to his own was not at all reassuring. The problem was in his hands, and it was an increasingly worrisome problem. Perhaps a deadly problem. He went to another sleeping room to follow Soames's example. It looked like sleep was going to be scarce.
Problem. A man from the future. An ordinary man without any special talents, without any great store of intelligence. The equivalent of the man in the street. A man who owns a fantastic little machine that turns sand into solid matter, harder than steel, but who hasn't the vaguest notion of how it works or how to analyze it. A man whose knowledge of past history is as vague and formless as any modern man's. A soldier with no other talent than fighting. What is to be done with such a man? Solution? Unknown. Lyle Sims pushed the coffee cup away. If he ever had to look at another cup of the disgusting stuff, he was sure he would vomit. 3 sleepless days and nights running on nothing but Dexedrine and hot black coffee had put his nerves more on edge than usual. He snapped at the clerks and secretaries, he paced endlessly, and he had ruined the stems of 5 pipes. He felt muggy and his stomach was queasy, yet there was no solution. It was impossible to say, "All right, we've got a man from the future. So what? Turn him loose and let him make a life for himself in our time, since he can't return to his own." It was impossible to do that, for several reasons. 1, what if he couldn't adjust? He was then a potential menace of incalculable potential. 2, what if an enemy power, and God knew there were enough powers around anxious to get a secret weapon as valuable as Quarlo, grabbed him and did somehow manage to work out the concepts behind the rifle, the firmer, the monoatomic anti-gravity device in the pouch? What then? 3, a man used to war, knowing only war, would eventually seek or foment war. There were dozens of others they were only beginning to realize. No, something had to be done with him. Imprison him? For what? The man had done no real harm. He had not intentionally caused the death of the man on the subway platform. He had been frightened by the train. He had been attacked by the executives, one of whom had a broken neck but was alive. No, he was just a stranger and afraid in a world I never made, as Houseman had put it so terrifyingly clearly. Kill him? For the same reasons, unjust and brutal, not to mention wasteful. Find a place for him in society? Doing what? Sims raged in his mind, mulled it over and tried every angle. It was an insoluble problem. A simple dog face with no other life than that of a professional soldier, what good was he? All Quarlo knew was war. The question abruptly answered itself. If he knows no other life than that of a soldier, why make him a soldier? But who was to say that with his knowledge of futuristic tactics and weapons, he might not turn into another Hitler or Genghis Khan? No, making him a soldier would only heighten the problem. There could be no peace of mind were he in a position where he might organize. As a tactician, then? It might work at that. Sims slumped behind his desk, pressed down the key of his intercom, spoke to the secretary. "Get me General Mainwaring, General Polk, and the Secretary of Defense." He clicked the key back. It just might work at that. If Quarlo could be persuaded to detail fighting plans, now that he realized where he was and that the men who held him were not his enemies and allies of Rusky Chink, and what a field of speculation that pair of words opened, it just might work. But Sims doubted it. Mainwaring stayed on to report when Polk and the Secretary of Defense went back to their regular duties. He was a big man, with softness written across his face and body and a pompous white mustache. He shook his head sadly, as though the Rosetta Stone had been stolen from him just before an all-important experiment.
"Sorry, Sims, but the man is useless to us. Brilliant grasp of military tactics, so long as it involves what he calls 80 thread beams and telepathic contacts. Do you know those wars up there are fought as much mentally as they are physically? Never heard of a tank or a mortar, but the stories he tells of brain burning and spore death would make you sick. It isn't pretty the way they fight. I thank God I'm not going to be around to see it. I thought our wars were filthy and unpleasant. They've got us licked all down the line for brutality and mass death. And the strange thing is, this Quarlo fellow despises it. For a while there, felt foolish as hell, but for a while there, when he was explaining it, I almost wanted to chuck my career, go out, and start beating the drum for disarmament." The general summed up, and it was apparent Quarlo was useless as a tactician. He had been brought up with one way of waging war, and it would take a lifetime for him to adjust enough to be of any tactical use. But it didn't really matter, for Sims was certain the general had given him the answer to the problem,
inadvertently. He would have to clear it with security, and the president, of course, and it would take a great deal of publicity to make the people realize this man actually was the real thing, an inhabitant of the future. But if it worked out, Quarlo Clebregni, the soldier and nothing but the soldier, could be the most valuable man time had ever spawned. He set to work on it, wondering foolishly if he wasn't too much the idealist. 10 soldiers crouched in the frozen mud. Their firmers had been jammed, had turned the sand and dirt of their holes only to ice-like conditions. The cold was seeping up through their suits, and the jammed firmers were emitting hard radiation. One of the men screamed as the radiation took hold in his gut and he felt the organs watering away. He leaped up, vomiting blood and phlegm, and was caught across the face by a robot-tracked triple beam. The front of his face disappeared, and the nearly decapitated corpse flopped back into the firmhole atop a comrade. That soldier shoved the body aside carelessly, thinking of his 4 children, lost to him forever in a rusky chink raid on Garmatopolis, sent to the bogs to work. His mind conjured up the sight of the 3 girls and the little boy with such long, long eyelashes, each dragging through the stinking bog, a mineral bag tied to the neck, collecting fuel rocks for the enemy. He began to cry softly. The sound and mental image of crying was picked up by a rusky chink telepath somewhere along the lines, and even before the man could catch himself, blank his mind, the telepath was on him. The soldier raised up from the firmhole bottom, clutching with crooked hands at his head. He began to tear at his features, wildly, screaming high and piercing as the enemy telepath burned away his brain. In a moment, his eyes were empty, staring shells, and the man flopped down beside his comrade, who had begun to deteriorate. A 38 thread whined its beam overhead, and the 8 remaining men saw a munitions wheel go up with a deafening roar. Hot shrapnel zoomed across the field, and a thin, brittle, knife-edged bit of plasteel arced over the edge of the firm hole and buried itself in one soldier's head. The piece went in crookedly, through his left earlobe, and came out skewering his tongue, half extended from his open mouth. From the side, it looked as though he were wearing some sort of earring. He died in spasms, and it took an awfully long while. Finally, the twitching and gulping got so bad, one of his comrades used the butt of a Brandelmeier across the dying man's nose. It splintered the nose, sent bone chips into the brain, killing the man instantly. Then, the attack call came. In each of their heads, the telepathic cry came to advance, and they were up out of the firmhole, all 7 of them, reciting their daily prayer and knowing it would do no good. They advanced across the slushy ground, and overhead they could hear the buzz of leech bombs coming down on the enemy's thread emplacements. All around them, in the deep-set night, the varicolored explosions popped and sugged, expanding in all directions like fireworks, then dimming the scene, again, the blackness. One of the soldiers caught a beam across the belly, and he was thrown sidewise for 10 feet, to land in a soggy heap, his stomach split open, the organs glowing and pulsing wetly from the charge of the threader. A head popped out of a firm hole before them, and 3 of the remaining 6 fired simultaneously. The enemy was a booby, rigged to backtrack their kill urge, rigged to a telepathic hookup, and even as the body exploded under their combined firepower, each of the men caught fire. Flames leaped from their mouths, from their pores, from the instantly charred spaces where their eyes had been. A pyrotic telepath had been at work. The remaining 3 split and cut away, realizing they might be thinking, might be giving themselves away. That was the horror of being just a dog face, not a special telepath behind the lines. Out here, all the options totaled nothing but death. A doggy mine slithered across the ground, entwined itself in the legs of one soldier, and blew his legs out from under him.
He lay there clutching the shredded stumps, feeling the blood soaking into the mud, and then unconsciousness seeped into his brain. He died shortly thereafter. Of the two left, one leaped a barb wall and blasted out a 38-thread emplacement of 12 men at the cost of the top of his head. He was left alive, and curiously, as though the war had stopped, he felt the top of himself, and his fingers pressed lightly against convoluted, slick matter for a second before he dropped to the ground. His brain case was open, glowed strangely in the night, but no one saw it. The last soldier dove under a beam that zzzed through the night and landed on his elbows. He rolled with a tumble, felt the edge of a leech bomb crater, and dove in headfirst. The beam split up his passage, and he escaped charring by an inch. He lay in the hole, feeling the cold of the battlefield seeping around him, and drew his cloak closer. The soldier was Quarlo. He finished talking and sat down on the platform. The audience was silent. Sims shrugged into his coat, fished around in the pocket for the cold pipe. The dottle had fallen out of the bowl, and he felt the dark grains at the bottom of the pocket. The audience was filing out slowly, hardly anyone speaking, but each staring at others around him, as though they were suddenly realizing what had happened to them, as though they were looking for a solution. Sims passed such a solution. The petitions were there, tacked up alongside the big sign, duplicate of the ones up all over the city. He caught the heavy black type on them as he passed through the auditorium's vestibule. "Sign this petition. Prevent what you have heard tonight." People were flocking around the petitions, but Sims knew it was only a token gesture at this point. The legislation had gone through that morning. No more war, under any conditions. An intelligence reported the long playing records, the piped broadcasts, the PA trucks had all done their jobs. Similar legislation was going through all over the world. It looked as though Quarlo had done it, single-handed. Sims stopped to refill his pipe and stared up at the big black-lined poster near the door. "Hear Quarlo, the soldier from the future. See the man from tomorrow and hear his stories of the wonderful world of the future. Free, no obligations, hurry." The advertising had been effective, and it was a fine campaign. Quarlo had been more valuable just telling about his wars, about how men died in that day in the future, than he could ever have been as a strategist. It took a real soldier who hated war to talk of it, to show people that it was ugly and unglamorous. And there was a certain sense of foul defeat, of hopelessness, in knowing the future was the way Quarlo described it. It made you want to stop the flow of time. Say, "No, the future will not be like this. We will abolish war." Certainly, enough steps in the right direction had been taken. The legislation was there, and those who had held back, who had tried to keep animosity alive, were being disposed of every day. Quarlo had done his work well. There was just one thing bothering Special Advisor Lyle Sims. The soldier had come back in time. So he was here, that much they knew for certain. But a nagging worry ate at Sims's mind, made him say prayers he had thought himself incapable of inventing, made him fight to get Quarlo heard by everyone. Could the future be changed? Or was it inevitable? Would the world Quarlo left inevitably appear? Would all their work be for nothing? It couldn't be. It dare not be. He walked back inside, got in line to sign the petitions again, though it was his 50th time.